Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
From the Jill Schwartz Memorial Library here in sultry Savannah, this is Obscure, Season 4, An American Tragedy. I am your host, your friend, your ear lover, and literary mansplainer-in-chief, Michael Ian Black, feeling quite sneezy. Allergy season has sprung here in the Deep South, where everything blooms far earlier than I am used to. When I lived above the Mason-Dixon line. And so if I start sneezing and gasping for air and you hear certain wet sounds emanating from my nostrils, you will understand the cause. I'm recording this on a Saturday. I usually record on Sundays, but Sunday, tomorrow, is both Easter and the day that the wife and I are heading off on a poker cruise, which maybe I mentioned before, maybe I didn't, but the way this thing came about is that I've got a friend who's a professional poker player and one of the more visible ones. And he said that he was pimping the cruise on his Twitter feed because the people who sponsor him are putting on this cruise. And so I said to him, hey, buddy, can you hook me up with the poker cruise people? Maybe I can wheedle my way onto the ship. So he did. And I wrote to them and I said, hey, I'm Michael Ian Black, very famous. Can I come be on your ship and perform, you know, as a comedian? And not only did they say yes, they were like, you bring Martha and we'll pay you money and the whole thing. So it's a fabulous excursion for us. We fly to Miami very early in the morning, sit around for several hours, then we embark, or we begin the embarkation process, as they say, when you are cruising. And then we're off and we go to, I mean, it doesn't even matter where we're going because I don't have any interest in the destinations. If it were up to me, I would not get off the boat at all. I don't care about seeing Bimini or Grand Cayman. That's not strictly true. I would be happy to see those places. It's just that when you're a cruise passenger and you disembark at these ports where they have the big cruise ships, basically you're just walking through a labyrinth of like jewelry stores and watch places and like touristy garbage and like, yeah, I just don't have any interest. So if it were up to me, I'd just stay on the ship the whole time, but Martha will probably want to disembark and who am I to deny my lady friend a good time? So when the time comes, I'm sure we will at the very least tootle around Grand Cayman because, you know, it's supposed to be nice. Do I believe it to be nice? I don't know. I think it's probably just like all those other islands. Nice and not so nice. I was on the West Coast all of last week doing some stand-up dates. Saw my daughter a couple of times, which was great. She came to see me perform in Irvine, California, and took her out. We had a good time, bought her some dinner, even though she was over an hour late meeting me. I'm not going to, look, who am I complaining to here? You? Her? Anybody? It's not her fault. It is, but I can't blame her because she's my daughter and she is blameless in all things unless she does something that jeopardizes my pocketbook, in which case I will sue her. I will ruin her. But this wasn't one of those instances. She just got stuck in traffic and so was over an hour late. But we had a grand time. Fun to see her, as always. And so I'm home for about 24 hours before embarkation. And so I thought I'd better take advantage of this short window to record an episode of the podcast, because although I like the idea of recording from my cabin and being seaside, as I think I have done before on this podcast series, the book, An American Tragedy, is so heavy. It's so big. I mean, listen. I mean, doesn't that sound, it just sounds like a door knocker, doesn't it? Well, that's me clanging the book against my computer, and man, oh man, like it's got some weight. So I'm already overpacked. I don't want to add to that. And so I'm going to do the podcast tonight. Not that you give a shit one way or the other. Why would you? You wouldn't. Last time, Clyde was getting the scenic tour of the factory where he has been assigned to work there in the shrinking room. This is the kind of bottom of the barrel job for those collar-making aspirants who want to make something of themselves in this delicious life. His cousin, Gilbert, has given him a position in the shrinking room where he is to report at 7:30 tomorrow morning. Mr. Wiggum is Gilbert's underling, but Mr. Wiggum is several steps ahead of Clyde's immediate superior, a man named Mr. Kemmerer, who is short, stocky, and full-chested. So last time, Wiggum had just sort of shown him around, and then he took his leave. And I know that because he said, well, I'll leave you now. So why don't we pick it up, alrighty, on book two, chapter 24, An American Tragedy. Mr. Wiggum, well, it really just says he lowered his head, but I'm going to say it's Wiggum. He lowered his head and started to go away, just as Clyde began. Well, I'm very much obliged to you, Mr. Wiggum. Instead of answering, he waved one fishy hand slightly upward and was gone. Now that is an adjective of which I quite approve, a fishy hand. I mean, I don't even know what that means, but it's so redolent, rich, just in that word, a fishy hand. I picture him sort of, when he says fishy, I think it implies a couple of things. The first is, if you were to shake his hand, it would probably be sort of soft and fishy, you know, and somewhat limp. But then as he's departing, I imagine his hand sort of flipping upwards like a flopping fish, you know, as he's just sort of casually taking his leave. So I like that. Fishy hand, slightly upward, and was gone. Down between the tubs toward the west door. And at once, Mr. Kemmerer, still nervous and overawed, apparently, began. Oh, that's all right about what you have to do, Mr. Griffiths. I'll just let you bring down webs on the floor above to begin with tomorrow, but if you've got any old clothes, you better put them on. Suit like that wouldn't last long here. He eyed Clyde's very neat, if inexpensive, suit in an odd way. His manner, quite like that of Mr. Wiggum before him, was a mixture of uncertainty and a very small authority here in Clyde's case, of extreme respect and yet some private doubt, which only time might resolve. Obviously, it was no small thing to be a Griffiths here, even if one were a cousin, and possibly not as welcome to one's powerful relatives as one might be. Right, so he's a Griffiths, but he's starting off there with him, with Kemmerer. You know, they're in the shit pits. We had gotten a full tour of the factory last week's episode, and we ended up in the shrinking room, and, well, here we are. And so Kemmerer's probably going, all right, he's a Griffiths, but what's he doing here? I better keep my eye on this little muskrat. At first sight, and considering what his general dreams in connection with this industry were, Clyde was inclined to rebel, for the type of youth and man he saw here were, in his estimation, and at first glance, rather below the type of individuals he hoped to find here, individuals neither so intelligent nor alert as those employed by the Union League and the Green Davidson by a long distance. Well, sure, because if you're in a public setting, like those smart fellows that he was working with at the various hotels, you got to be, well, smart, put together, neatly attired. But here, probably in the shit pits, you know, the guys are greasy and sweaty and probably a little rough around the edges. They've never had to polish their manners, and so when they're down in the factory, yeah, they're gonna appear a little bit more like ruffians to Clyde. However, I find it odd that Clyde, coming from where he comes, would be in any position to judge anybody. And yet, there he is, because he is, if nothing else, human. And still worse, he felt them to be much more subdued and sly and ignorant. Mere clocks, really. And their eyes, as he entered with Mr. Wiggum, while they pretended not to be looking, were very well aware, as Clyde could feel, of all that was going on. Indeed, he and Mr. Wiggum were the center of all their secret looks. At the same time, their spare and practical manner of dressing struck dead at one blow any thought of refinement in connection with the work in here. How unfortunate that his lack of training would not permit his being put to office work or something like that upstairs. Well, I mean, we're already running into just a slight bit of friction here, are we not? Clyde looking down his nose at his superiors, starting with Gilbert, all the way down to Kemmerer, as if, who is he? He's nobody. He's just a little shit that begged for a job from his uncle. His uncle gave it to him, and now he's walking around acting like he's better than everybody else. Ah! Stick it in your hat, Clyde. He walked with Mr. Kemmerer, who troubled to say that these were the tubs in which the webs were shrunk overnight. These the centrifugal dryers, these the rack dryers. Then he was told that he could go, and by then, it was only 3 o'clock. He made his way out of the nearest door, and once outside, he congratulated himself on being connected with this great company, while at the same time wondering whether he was going to prove satisfactory to Mr. Kemmerer and Mr. Wiggum. Supposing he didn't. Or, supposing he couldn't stand all this, it was pretty rough. Well, if worst came to worst, as he now thought, he could go back to Chicago, or on to New York, maybe, and get work. But why hadn't Samuel Griffiths had the graciousness to receive and welcome him? Why had that young Gilbert Griffiths smiled so cynically? And what sort of woman was this Mrs. Braley? Had he done wisely to come on here? Would this family do anything for him now that he was here? Well, you know what, Clyde? I get it. You know, you're a kid. You're coming to work. You're in a new city. You're both awed by the enormity of the enterprise that you are entering, but also somewhat disappointed and dismayed by the position you yourself hold. However, Clyde, one has to imagine that a Griffiths would not long be part of the sort of bottom of the barrel work there, because it would be embarrassing to them, you know, to have their poor country cousin slaving away in the tubs while they're all getting fat and happy on bison steaks. I don't know why bison steaks, but why not? So, you know, if Clyde could just put this in perspective, if he just trusted, as they say, the process, he would probably find himself a bit more optimistic about his future there. Because if it's me, and I'm Clyde Griffiths, I'm thinking to myself, yeah, this is going to suck. All these, shrinking down this fabric, that's just going to suck. Dick. But if I apply myself rigorously to the task without complaint, and I do my job efficiently and well, and more or less silently, or perhaps in concert with the workers that I will be standing cheek by jowl with, then it's probably likely that I will get promoted, maybe more quickly than somebody else in my position would. So I'm going to learn the business from the ground up, and I'm going to take pride in every aspect of it. That would be my attitude, but of course, I'm a grown-ass man and not some, you know, slick 20-year-old fresh off the train from the second city. Let's see if Clyde takes my advice. It was thus that, strolling west along River Street, on which were a number of other kinds of factories, and then north through a few other streets that held more factories, tinware, wick wire, a big vacuum carpet cleaning plant, a rug manufacturing company, and the like, that he came finally upon a miserable slum, the like of which, small as it was, he had not seen outside of Chicago or Kansas City. He was so irritated and depressed by the poverty and social angularity and crudeness of it, all spelling but one thing, social misery, to him, that he at once retraced his steps and, recrossing the Mohawk by a bridge farther west, soon found himself in an area which was very different indeed, a region once more of just such homes as he had been admiring before he left for the factory. And walking still farther south, he came upon that same wide and tree-lined avenue which he had seen before, the exterior appearance of which alone identified it as the principal residence thoroughfare of Lycurgus. It was so very broad and well-paved and lined by such an arresting company of houses. At once, he was very much alive to the personnel of this street, for it came to him immediately that it must be in this street very likely that his Uncle Samuel lived. The houses were nearly all of French, Italian, or English design, and excellent period copies at that, although he did not know it. All right, let's take a little break. I'll go blow my nose or sneeze or scratch my eyes or do something as I navigate my allergies here, back in a moment on Obscure.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be. Welcome to Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high-profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he'll chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Back on Obscure with Clyde Griffiths, roaming the principal residential thoroughfare there in Lycurgus, New York. And it reminds me, actually, of here in Savannah, there's a street called, Victory. Victory Boulevard, I think, is probably exactly what this street in Lycurgus is like. So on Victory, there's all these just gorgeous, enormous homes that have been there, I would guess, probably since the early part of the 20th century, probably up into the 20s or 30s, I would guess they were built. And they're all along this beautiful sort of tree-lined boulevard. Unfortunately, over the years, that street has become a major thoroughfare. So you've got these gorgeous homes, but they're on this street with a lot of traffic. And Martha and I routinely remark to each other, my gosh, these homes are pretty, but I wouldn't want to live there because of just all the cars going by. I think that's probably what happened to the main road in Lycurgus, although how could I know? Yeah, they probably put his Staples next to one of those houses and ruined everything. So he's looking at these houses of French, Italian, and English design, and that is a very common early 20th century thing to, like, you know, these classic revivals. So that's what he's doing. He's admiring them. Impressed by their beauty and spaciousness, however, he walked along, now looking at one and another, and wondering which, if any, of these was occupied by his uncle, and deeply impressed by the significance of so much wealth. How superior and condescending his cousin Gilbert must feel, walking out of some such place as this in the morning. Then pausing before one which, because of trees, walks, newly groomed, if bloomless, flower beds, a large garage at the rear, a large fountain to the left of the house as he faced it, in the center of which was a boy holding a swan in his arms. What? And to the right of the house, one lone cast-iron stag pursued by some cast-iron dogs. Man, I just have to return to this. A large fountain to the left of the house. Oh, I see. It's a statuary boy holding a swan. In the center of the fountain was a boy holding a swan. Okay. And then there's the cast-iron dogs and the cast-iron stag, which he felt especially impelled to admire and charmed by the dignity of this place, which was a modified form of Old English, which in my mind means Tudor. He now inquired of a stranger who was passing, a middle-aged man of a rather shabby working type. "Whose house is that, mister?" And the man replied, "Why, that's Samuel Griffith's residence. He's the man who owns the big collar factory over the river." I don't know why, but he owns the big collar factory down by the river. Man, something about that just made me laugh. I made myself laugh. It's embarrassing, but it happened. I apologize. At once, Clyde straightened up as though dashed with cold water. His uncle's. His residence. Then that was one of his automobiles standing before the garage at the rear there. And there was another visible through the open door of the garage. Now they've got two automobiles. Can you imagine? Two! Indeed, in his immature and really psychically unilluminated mind, it suddenly evoked a mood which was of roses, perfumes, lights, and music. The beauty, the ease. What member of his own immediate family had ever even dreamed that his uncle lived thus? The grandeur. And his own parents, so wretched, so poor, preaching on the streets of Kansas City, and no doubt Denver, conducting a mission. And although thus far no single member of his family, other than his chill cousin, had troubled to meet him, and that at the factory only, and although he had been so indifferently assigned to the menial type of work that he had, still he was elated and uplifted. For after all, was he not a Griffiths? A full cousin as well as a full nephew to the two very important men who lived here, and now working for them in some capacity at least. And must not that spell a future? This is what I was talking about. And must not that spell a future of some sort better than any he had known as yet? For consider who the Griffiths were here, as opposed to who the Griffiths were in Kansas City, say, or Denver. The enormous difference. A thing to be carefully concealed as possible. Well, come on, man. I mean, yes, I get it. You're a kid looking to make his way up, and you've got this, what do they have? The golden ticket, as they say in Willy Wonka. You've got that golden ticket, your surname, Griffiths. There in Lycurgus, New York, there could be no finer ticket than that. And yet, there he is, as we said, in the basement shit pits. So, we understand the contrast that he's feeling right now, the feeling of elation and feeling uplifted, mixed with the confusion and, well, dismay is too strong a word, but well, let's just say anxiety about his current position. At the same time, he was immediately reduced again for supposing the Griffiths here, his uncle or his cousin or some friend or agent of theirs, should now investigate his parents and his past. Heavens! The matter of that slain child in Kansas City, his parents' miserable makeshift life, Esta. At once his face fell, his dreams being so thickly clouded over. If they should guess, if they should sense. Oh, the devil, who was he anyway? And what did he really amount to? What could he hope for from such a great world as this, really, once they knew why he had troubled to come here? A little disgusted and depressed, he turned to retrace his steps, for all at once he felt himself very much of a nobody. End of chapter 24. Well, so we've sort of seen the highs and lows with Clyde right now. And in chapter 24, he shows up and, like Curtis, he gets the tour of the factory, meets his cousin, he gets shown the shrinking room, and his own spirits have begun to shrink as he contemplates what would happen if his past were to be uncovered. The matter of the poor slain girl in Kansas City, for example, which really is not his fault in any way, shape, or form. He was merely in the car. He is not to be blamed. Yes, he was egging on Ratterer, or whoever it was that was driving. It wasn't Ratterer, but whoever was driving the car, I can't remember now. And yes, they'd all been drinking and cavorting and carousing, but he no more ran over that little girl than I did. And I can assure you, I did not. At least, that is my story. Chapter 25. The room which Clyde secured this same day with the aid of Mrs. Braley was in Thorpe Street, a thoroughfare enormously removed in quality, if not in distance, from that in which his uncle resided. Indeed, the difference was sufficient to decidedly qualify his mounting notions of himself as one who, after all, was connected with him. What? Indeed, the difference was sufficient to decidedly qualify his mounting notions of himself as one who, after all, was connected with him. I really don't know what they're saying here. Indeed, the difference was sufficient, the difference between the house on Thorpe Street and the fancy one, to decidedly qualify his mounting notions of himself as one who, after all, was connected with him. I'm not sure what's qualifying about this. I don't quite understand, but let's leave it. The commonplace brown or gray or tan colored houses, rather smoked or decayed, which fronted it, the leafless and winter-harried trees, which in spite of smoke and dust, seemed to give promise of the newer life so near at hand, the leaves and flowers of May. Yet as he walked into it with Mrs. Braley, many drab and commonplace figures of men and girls and elderly spinsters resembling Mrs. Braley in kind were making their way home from the several factories beyond the river. And at the door, Mrs. Braley and himself were received by a none too polished woman in a clean gingham apron over a dark brown dress, who led the way to a second floor room, not too small or uncomfortably furnished, which she assured him he could have for $4 without board or $7.50 with, a proposition which, seeing that he was advised by Mrs. Braley that this was somewhat better than he would get in most places for the same amount, he decided to take. And here, after thanking Mrs. Braley, he decided to remain, later sitting down to dinner with a small group of Milltown store and factory employees, such as partially he had been accustomed to in Paulina Street in Chicago, before moving to the better atmosphere of the Urban League. And after dinner, he made his... This is all the same paragraph, by the way. Chapter 25 has begun with this paragraph and remains with this paragraph, and I've just looked ahead, and it continues for at least a little bit longer. So he sits down in Paulina Street, the Union League, and after dinner, he made his way out into the principal thoroughfares of Lycurgus, only to observe such a crowd of nondescript mill workers as, judging these streets by day, he would not have fancied swarmed here by night. Girls and boys, men and women of various nationalities and types, Americans, Poles, Hungarians, French, English, and for the most part, if not entirely, touched with a peculiar something. Ignorance, or thickness of mind or body, or with a certain lack of taste and alertness or daring, which seemed to mark them one and all, as of the basement world which he had only seen this afternoon. Yet in some streets and stores, particularly those near Wikigi, let's go with Wikigi, that's sort of fun to say, Wikigi Avenue, a better type of girl and young man who might have been and no doubt were of the various office groups of the different companies over the river, neat and active. So that is the end of the first paragraph to chapter 25, and we will leave it there. But here we have Clyde Griffiths essentially doing a kind of a geological survey of the different strata of social classes there in Lycurgus, New York. At the very top, of course, you've got the Griffiths family and their ilk who reside on that principal residential thoroughfare in their big fancy houses with their statuary and their boys holding swans. And then at the other end of it, you've got the slum that Clyde saw when he left the factory immediately and sort of wandered around and saw the shanty town that was there, and then his own room in somewhat elevated circumstances from that, yet far removed from those of his uncle and slightly removed from those of the office folk that he encounters as he wanders through the city. What I'm unclear about here is, I suspect I understand it. Well, I'm hoping that I understand it, because if not, then we're in some trouble. But Dreiser, I believe, is not of Clyde's mind when regarding these immigrants who are working alongside Clyde in the shit pits of all the different factories, the wire factory and the, you know, the vacuum cloth, carpet, whatever they're doing, making bells and plates and bicycle wheels, or who knows what they're making. But every factory must have a shit pit, and the people fresh off the boat, that's where they end up, and Clyde's right there with them, and he feels a little offended, and he looks at them, and they are not the sort of people that he wants to be rubbing elbows with. He wants to be back there at the Union League at Chicago, fetching packages for smart folks from Topeka and Milwaukee and New York City and Newark, New Jersey, and all points in between. That's the sort of person that he wants to be with, sort of person his uncle is. But he knows he's going to have to make his way up the social classes if he ever wants to arrive at his imminent destination. Well, we don't know that it's imminent, but there wouldn't be a book if he didn't rise, would there? No, there would not. So we'll leave it there. I'm about to head out on the high seas. I've got my jaunty captain's hat perched upon my head already. And looking forward to a week of poker playing, stand-up comedy, and soft-serve ice cream. So I will leave you there, and we will pick it up again on another overawing, because I like that word. No, you know what? You know what I like better? Another fishy episode of Obscure. But until then, I wish you adieu. This season of Obscure is produced by me, Michael Ian Black, and Robin Lynn. Our theme music is by Craig Wedren. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Michael Ian Black, and get even more Obscure content at our site, patreon.com/Michael Ian Black. Thank you for listening.
Ah, spring. Nothing like the world progressing towards summer to inspire your own progress. That's what life's all about, in your career, relationships, and your finances. Let's talk about that last one. With the Chime Secured Credit Builder Visa Credit Card, it's easy to start building credit with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments with no annual fees or interest. So your weekly grocery run can feel even more productive, and that morning coffee can taste like a little victory. And if your credit scores grow, so could your opportunities to get lower rates on loans, like for a new ride or finally having a home to call your own. Sounds like progress, right? With Chime's secure credit card, you can start improving your credit scores right away. Get started today at chime.com/build. That's chime.com/build. Chime feels like progress. The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A., members FDIC. Out-of-network ATM withdrawal and OTC advance fees may apply. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.